Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable live from Rhinecliff, New York at the Morton Memorial Library on this Wednesday, the 26th of March. How do you tell it's a live audience? Because they do this. There, look at that. Full house on a Wednesday morning, and we couldn't be more delighted to be on the banks of the Hudson River in the beautiful Hudson Valley. We are looking to come to communities to talk about what's on your mind. Obviously, as we come into communities, there are a lot of issues that are, of course, special to that particular place, but also places that, like Rhinecliff and like the Hudson Valley, that certainly feel and mirror and reflect what is going on nationally. So we're starting a process of going through our listening area and doing live broadcasts, and this is the first time we've ever brought the panel on the road, so before a live audience. So we're very, very excited about that. And man, what a doozy of a panel we have. Let me introduce them to you right now. For those of you staring at your radio to the far right, we have John Faso, attorney, politician, U.S. representative for the New York 19th Congressional District. Good morning. How are you?
Great. Great to be here in Rhinecliff.
Rhinecliff.
And also in this beautiful Morton Memorial Library. It's really terrific. Great community resources. Great resource. And great to see all of our visitors here today. It's great to be with you all.
It's wonderful to have you, as always. We also welcome Anna Markowitz to the program, a former Biden administration official, and will have a cool new job title soon, which we will tell you about when... Oh, by the way, will you still be able to do the show?
I sure hope so.
Okay, all right.
And well, I'm proud to be on the far left.
Yeah.
I would just like to say that.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Anna Markowitz. One of our regulars who is just a wonderful addition to our panel, has been with us for a few years now, and hails from Poughkeepsie, and is just a wonderful, wonderful resource for us. He's a investment banker on Wall Street. Mark Whitman is here. Good morning, Mark.
Thank you, Joe. When I saw your signal message to Anna, I thought I would hop on and accept the invitation since you're right in my neighborhood here.
Yeah, we gave the bomb location.
Did you know just by JD that it was me?
It was that little green character with the eyeballs on top.
Yeah,
of the
okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's
Did
right.
You thank him.
We also welcome, this is just one of my favorite people in the whole world, best-selling author, co-founder of the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck. Please welcome Elizabeth Lesser.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I work on this side of the river. I live on the other side in Woodstock, New York, and love WAMC. And thank you, Joe. Thanks for having us.
It's a wonderful pleasure to have you here and for you to be a part of the program. I like to call this man my friend because he's cool, and it makes me look good with my friends. He is a best-selling author, a journalist, a professor of English at Vassar College. His new book is My Beloved Life, which is just absolutely amazing, as are all of his novels. He has an incredible new piece in The New Yorker. Will you please welcome Amitava Kumar? We also are lucky enough to have Danah Mengestu with us, a freelance journalist, author of three novels, and has reported about life in Darfur, northern Uganda, and eastern Congo. Teaches at Bard College, correct?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And it's an absolute thrill to have Danah Mengestu with us this morning. Thank you very, very much. Then we welcome an iconic writer whose latest book is a memoir about self-reflection and a vibrant exploration of the modern dynamics of gender and identity. Also has been a bard for a very long time. Will you please welcome Lucy Sant? Last but certainly not least, best-selling author, memoirist, essayist, cultural critic, and just all-around badass. Her new book is 1974. Francine Prose is here.
Thank you, Joe. I'll just let that introduction sing.
So, what the hell's going on? I'm interested in the thoughts that you have in a day-to-day. All of you have professional lives. All of you work very hard in various pursuits. And I'm wondering, so you look at, let's just take a story from today about the text leak, which of course was from earlier this week, but is obviously still quite relevant. But without talking about that specifically, I'm curious, and Amitabh will begin with you. I'm just curious as to like how you kind of process all that and figure out, you know, where we are in this moment. In your piece in The New Yorker, you had just come from India. You write about this amazing trip, and I assume you can't help but compare.
Yeah, all over the world, the rise of quote-unquote strong men and the interest amidst all this chaos, the interest in trying to find someone who will be strong, who will make cuts, who will clean up the system, that's a very strong seduction, and somehow people fall into the trap of thinking that such wild remedies are possible. I was on this train in India going from Kashmir to Kanyakumari. I wanted to ask people questions about what has changed in our country? Where are we now compared to 20 years ago? What are your interests? Just so that I could, by talking to people, find the temperature of the country in some ways. And I think what is happening in the last few weeks in this country, if you're on Facebook as much as I am, you'll notice that there have been lots of town hall meetings. There is a great interest in all kinds of communities to collect and talk about what is happening here, you know? So there is a curiosity, I suppose. There's a desire to make sense of where are we going? What are the decisions we are making? What do we need to do? How can people come together and maybe perhaps in some countries or in some situations have dialogue? I think, in America, we are lucky to be able to meet like this and have dialogues. In many countries, people with differences would not even be sitting in the same room. You know what I'm saying? And so that's my first observation about my own desire to be on a train and then be here having a public conversation where questions are being thrown. Joe, in his genial way, presiding over a general town hall meeting, you know? And people, I'm sure, will come up with differences. It's a wonderful thing to be able to have a dialogue.
So, Dana, how do we protect that?
How do we protect that capacity for dialogue?
Yes.
I think we've actually already lost it. I think it's great, the idea that we're all here having a conversation, but I think we also lose sight of the number of people who can't be here and aren't able to be here because they're already under increasing pressure and threat. So I think our ability to talk honestly has already collapsed because we don't have the capacity to have all the people in the room who should be a part of those conversations. If your status in the U.S. is even slightly vulnerable right now, the idea that you would come out publicly and speak about what you're facing and what your family might be facing, that's not, you know, maybe a small number of people are willing to take that risk, but I think many people aren't, and for very good reason. So I think we're already at the state where we've lost a lot. I think until we begin to recognize that we have already lost a lot and that what we are trying to do is make sure we don't lose more, we can't begin to claw our way out of this problem. So, I mean, right now I feel like the damage is already really profound, and the idea that these restrictions on our speech, you know, they've centered on so many different kind of critical issues, but that obviously it's about kind of controlling what all of us feel like we can say. And as soon as you begin to take people out of the conversation, you begin to take people out of the room, the level of our discourse is already diminished, and the complexity of what we can understand and what we can say is already gone. So I think we have to be much angrier. I think we have to be much more vocal about the conversations that we're not having, and we need to try to imagine who's not in these, all the people who aren't in these spaces with us right now.
So I think of you, Lucy. You transitioned at the age of 66, and now are in this moment. And I can't imagine what that. Obviously, there is the, which you write about beautifully in your book, which we can talk about a little bit later, but the actual decision and the transition, and but then the world at large and how trans people are seen.
Yeah, well, you know, the has seemed like a trans moment, which maybe has gone on for as long as 10, 15, 20 years now. And that's through a whole bunch of cultural signs happening that people felt emboldened, especially the younger generation. And somehow, I almost feel like it wasn't in my conscious control at all, responded finally to stuff I'd been sitting on my entire life. Since single digits, I was suddenly freed to move forward. It was made possible by traditional kinship structures breaking down around the globe. And this fascism we're facing is a direct response to that. It's almost like the two halves of an egg. Matter and antimatter, two halves of an egg. It was never a comfortable situation for trans people and never has been at any point in life. But except that, you know, a lot of it flew under the radar because people weren't looking for it. Now, suddenly, there's this, pseudo-religious objections to it. And then, you know, bingo, the president of the United States declares that we do not exist. And, you know, I'm sure he doesn't care, Trump, but he's pressured by the religious right. And the right wing in general wants to make things simpler. And when something is clear cut as the, you know, A, B, you know, one gender, the other gender, when that dichotomy gets fractured, there are more things appearing in between those poles or outside of them, then, you know, suddenly a lot of people can't compute anymore. And of course, we are a threat to male supremacy, because once you declare that there are areas between the genders, then that really deprives men from saying we are men and we can do this and women can't do that. So, you know, so much of what's going on in Washington is goofy retrograde action, trying to drag the train back to the yards with chains. It may work through terror, but ultimately it'll fail, as all such things have.
I do want to ask you a follow-up, which is that you've made this point that you do look at it because you're older and you've gone through this experience, that you do look at a lot of it from afar.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Well, I'm not in... You know, there is such a thing or things as trans communities, Brooklyn, various places among the young, college campuses. Look, I'm 40. The few times I've ever been to a trans function, I've been 40 years older than anybody in the room. And my experiences are very different. They're also much more nuanced, you know, because I've seen a lot of life, seen a lot of exceptions, can't quite hold to an ideology about it. And also, frankly, I live right across the river here, and don't leave my house ever, except when I'm going public. I sort of have two modes, very private or very public and nothing in between. I'm watching this with, you know, obviously alarm and consternation, and I'm not so afraid for myself, but for my younger people, I'm terrified for them.
Mark Whitman, one of the questions that we get asked so often on the panel is, what can we do about the current situation? And that's from people from both sides, quite frankly. But I'm interested in your thoughts on that, as to when we look at where we are now of processing what we process and being able to try to move forward in a positive direction.
That's a great... Joe, thanks for the easy question.
Yeah, solve that, Mark, and get back to me, okay?
In my preparation for today, after I got out of the corner and stopped sobbing that I would be on such an august panel, I actually noticed that there's a real commonality here, in that most of these folks here deal with identities that have been forged by journeys, either geographical or intensely personal. And there is a middle of this country, if you will, that we lost clearly in the last election. Folks that, by my diagnosis, believe that they were under threat economically and perhaps even socially by the left. So actually, Joe, the question I have for everyone here, since personal identity is such a key focus, is we've got to figure out, frankly, how to appeal to those folks that got duped and help them better understand why their interests align with what we historically consider a liberal democracy. And to me, that's, I guess, the framing of the question more than a solution, but at least it's a first step towards that solution. And I do think the group we have assembled today could offer meaningful insight.
John Fasso, while you may take umbrage at the word duped, but there's still... And I know this about you, very much a want for people to be able to get together and find common ground.
Absolutely, and this is a great forum to do that, and your radio audience also affords us a great opportunity to communicate. I think one of the big problems we face in our country is that people tend to self-segregate themselves and get into groupthink and bubbles. They listen, read, and watch things that they already agree with. So it becomes a self-confirming cycle. And it's very often that you find...
Because reading anything else just drives you nuts.
Well, you know, I think there actually are a lot of sources, but you have to work to find them sometimes. And I think also I occasionally am in Washington. I was there the last couple of days and over the weekend, in fact. And you find that so many of the folks that get the attention are people who are, show horses. They're not workhorses. They're interested in getting on cable TV, whether it's Fox or MSNBC or CNN, whatever it is, and they want to appeal to the more extreme nature. And you see this in terms of the social media and the internet. You know, politicians have to, in the House of Representatives, for instance, you got to run for office every 2 years. And if you're in a swing district like I was, that means you have to raise a lot of money. And you have to spend a lot of time doing that. And what you see so often with these folks who are on both extremes, that they're using these messages in order to help them attract attention, which helps them raise money. And they're not so much focused on the people in D.C., and they're good Democrats and good Republicans on both sides, and there are also some horrific people on both sides. And the ones that are out there constantly trying to get attention in the media, they are, frankly, they're not workhorses. They're not there doing the day-to-day stuff. What I get frustrated about as well is that we are faced with an extreme crisis in terms of the West. the democracies, and I include in that South Korea and Japan and Australia, et cetera. But we have an existential threat from those on the other side, and I mean Xi Jinping and Putin and the Iranians, who believe that their system is better, that the top-down autocratic system is better. The comment before of our fellow panelists about strongmen. Well, we know we have some real strongmen in Xi Jinping and Putin and others, and they're saying to the rest of the world, particularly the developing world, you know, those democracies, they're a mess. Look at the kind of controversies they have and back and forth. That's not the system that works. And I fundamentally believe that this system does work. I'm confident in the future. We have bumps in the road. We've always had them in our history. And this is a time where I hear people say, oh, we're in a constitutional crisis. Oh, it's never been so bad. Well, how about the Civil War? How about Pearl Harbor? You know, this country, how about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and their adherents going at each other, hammer and tong, calling each other all sorts of insufferable things? So I think it's important for us to have context that where we are today, what is manifested, how Donald Trump was able to win and the movement that he leads is something that was long developing. But I have confidence in our system and in the stability of the system. And I do think that ultimately the checks and balances always seem to be able to get us through whatever we're in at the moment. And this is a moment where it's deeply controversial. But I think oftentimes Americans, we are losing sight of our common bond in terms of the system that we have over almost 250 years when we have an existential threat we're seeing from Xi Jinping, from Putin, and their like, because they believe our system doesn't work. And I think that's the fundamental thing that, frankly, most of the people in this room are in the same demographic I am. It's our kids and our grandchildren that are really going to have to face this issue.
So with that said, Francine Prose, you wrote in The Guardian on the night that Donald Trump won re-election, I look the way people do outside the intensive care unit as they wait to learn whether a friend will survive. Our friend in this case is democracy. That is, that's not as rosy a picture as John painted.
No, I don't feel that it's rosy. But in fact, when I think about all my anxieties before the election, they just seem like a joke now. I mean, I really didn't have the imagination to predict what's happening now, although I have a fabulous imagination for disaster. This was beyond that. So I do think we're in an extreme situation and an unprecedented situation. I mean, twice at Bard and once in the Eastern Correctional Facility, I taught classes in totalitarianism and literature. And perhaps I know too much about it or have read too much about it or thought too much about it, but the steps by which a democratic society or a reasonably equitable society moves towards totalitarianism and fascism are very familiar, and there's a pattern, and I can see that pattern happening now. At the same time, we all live in this kind of schizoid moment, knowing that people from our own communities who are undocumented are getting deported, and the idea that when I was coming up in the 60s, you could have demonstrations and you could, I know someone who climbed the walls of the Pentagon. If that happened today, that person would be on the first flight to El Salvador. So the things that are happening now have never happened before. But at this moment, the peculiar thing about our lives is that one part of our brain knows that this is happening, and another part of our brain says, oh, that email from 2 days ago that I forgot to answer, you know, from a student, whatever. So we're toggling back and forth between a sense of how frightening things are, and then the ability to lead, for most of us in the room, the same kind of lives that we were leading before, at the same time that many other people cannot lead the lives that they were leading before.
Anna, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that right now we're seeing a flood the zone by the Trump administration, and it makes it really hard to focus on one specific issue that might unite us. And we feel like because there are so many issues, he seems invincible. He's able to get his way in a lot of court rulings. He's attacking the press, and people are calling the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America now on Google Maps. We're seeing all these wins, and it's hard feeling so unempowered. And I would love to see us focus on one specific thing that really brings everybody together and get a significant win so that we can see that this isn't an unpenetratable force. Something like Social Security, which Trump and Musk are calling a Ponzi scheme, and they're coming after our Poughkeepsie Social Security office and threatening to close it, which luckily it's off the DOGE list for now, but you know, it really makes you worry about these programs that we once thought were a third rail of politics and now seem kind of on the table. And so I hope that we as a society can unify around things that affect all of us, Social Security, free school meals for children. There's so many issues, but picking one or two that we could really win on, I think, would be very interesting.
Elizabeth Lesser, the anxiety that many people feel, how do we find the center, not politically, but within ourselves, to be able to, and I like what you said, Francine, about that idea of toggling back and forth to what is happening in our world and our responsibilities as citizens and parents and spouses and partners.
You know, I've had the blessing and the curse to be a meditator and a spiritual seeker my whole life. And the blessing is that I do have tools that help me pause and cool my reactivity. But the curse is that I see things from everyone's point of view all the time. Like, I agreed with so much of what you said, and I agreed with so much of what you said. And it often, I think this is a moment for so many of us, and maybe for many of you in the room, we don't know what to do, because doing anything, to me, when I look at the rage I feel and I want to go into the streets, I know that's just going to have so much backlash right now. I don't think it will help. We will know when it will help, but I don't think it is now. And I think a lot of us are feeling this, like, what do we do when a strong man, and I do believe he is a strong man, you know, I fear him as much as I fear Xi and Putin. What do we do when a strongman has come in and erased so many of our values? My last book was about women, and like you said, Francine, like, my fears in that book are like absurd compared to what's going on now. So I think it's critically important for all of us to calm our nervous systems, because actions that come from a sense of terror often have the exact opposite effect of what we want to see happen. So to me, one of my most precious spiritual practices right now is to have a historical perspective and to know that we have gotten through things like this before. This is not the first rodeo in America where people's rights were being trampled on. And I do have faith in our system. I do. And I think that is something to water. I think it's important to water the seeds of patience and faith. But I also think it's important to stay vigilant and aware. Unfortunately, I can't use a word right now that I consider my main practice these days. It's I saw it on a bumper sticker: "Do no harm, but take no." Starts with it's S H I T. I'll call it crap. Do no harm, but take no crap. This is something that I say to myself every morning when I wake up, like, I'm going to have a very soft and open and loving and accepting heart. I'm going to try to do no harm today, but I am not going to take any crap. I'm going to have a very strong back. This is the posture of meditation, strength and openness and softness at the same time. And I try to walk through the world that way. And that is how I calm my nervous system.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We are broadcasting live from the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York. And it's the roundtable panel, an amazing group of individuals. I'll reintroduce them on the way back in. And we'll return right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable's live broadcast from Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York. The Roundtable is on the road. We're putting miles on the van. John Faso, Anna Markowitz, Mark Whitman, Amitava Kumar, Elizabeth Lesser, Dinah Mengestu, Francine Prose, and Lucy Sand, all our guests this morning. We've heard from all of them. And before we go to the top of the hour break, I was taken by what two things that were said in our opening, and that is Elizabeth talking about this mantra of take no crap, and Dinah, what you said of we have to get angry. How do you see that manifesting itself in a way that is I don't know. I'm going to say, at least initially, safe, but also effective.
I mean, I think it manifests individually, you know, not being afraid to say what you obviously sort of feel, being able to, you know, call fascism, call terror when you see it. But then also, I think we all belong to institutions, right? We're all a part of institutions. And those institutions, historically, in times like this, don't do very good. They're not very good at standing up to terror. And so I think that we need those institutions to do better. We need them to actually become much more fierce in their advocacy. We need them to defend like fundamental rights of free speech and free expression that they are not willing to do. It will come at a price, right? And I think it also means like knowing that that defense isn't going to come easy and being aware that we might have to pay a price for that, right? But that price is going to be worth paying. Either our institutions clearly show that they don't want to pay those prices, that they would rather risk losing some of their $1 billion in you know legal fees in order not to have to defend their right to actually be lawyers. So if we can't bear some of those burdens ourselves, then I think it's hard to ask our institutions to do it, but I think we have to do that. I think we have to demand that we don't bend over as easily or as quickly as they would like.
So many of you are teach, and I'm curious when you say institutions, but academic institutions. So how does it come to you of how you bring it out in the classroom?
I mean, I think it comes in one, not being afraid to talk about obviously the moment that we're in and understanding and sometimes being very open about the fact that like maybe you are nervous about saying a particular thing. Maybe you are nervous about, you know, the other evening we had a conversation with a writer and we were talking about the government's, the CIA's influence on writers. And you do sometimes worry like, oh, like actually who's in this room right now? And then you also worry about your students and their own safety and their ability to speak freely. So I think some of it is acknowledging openly the threat that we're all under and knowing that this is not a singular experience, that this is a collective experience that we all share in. And then being able to kind of see through that and continue the discourse that they would rather we not continue.
Amitava, how about in your... Yeah. In your teaching?
Well, yesterday I taught two classes, and I'll speak very briefly about both. The first class was a journalism class, and we read an article called The Plague Year by Lawrence Wright about the first year of COVID. And my question to my students was that if we think about all the things that happened, the three things, for example, that Lawrence Wright says went wrong immediately, the CDC in China refusing to let the CDC officials from America to come in early January. Second, the Trump administration throwing away the Obama administration's playbook about how to respond to a pandemic. And thirdly, the president's mixed messaging, including things like, oh no, I don't wear masks. I will not wear masks. It is voluntary. I said to my students, all these things, why was it? Do you remember all of this happening? And if you don't remember all of this happening, then why should, you know what Mark was talking about, those people who are not with us, why should they have remembered? There's such an amnesia about all that happens in our lives, about history, really. Mm-hmm. And so my encouragement to my students is, how do we become witnesses? How do we keep a record of the daily depredations? And so that we are not the most forgetful people, but actually we remember. And we don't remember then. We remember 4 years later not to re-elect people who have led us down the path to hell. The other class was on post-colonial literature, and we read a book by Isabella Hamad on a performance of Hamlet in Gaza, on the West Bank, actually. And so there, too, I was just thinking about memory. Again, you know, when I came to this country, on the campuses, there were protests about apartheid in South Africa. And certainly to me, in my early 20s, I felt that that apartheid regime was never going to end, that injustice was not going to end. But one morning, I was working on my dissertation, I was a young graduate student, and Nelson Mandela came out of prison and walked free. And so my question to these students was, how do you keep hope alive that injustice will end, that apartheid systems that exist today in other parts of the world will also come to an end, and how do we devise its ending? My belief is in art, and I wanted them to think about how a play being performed somewhere, rewritten somewhere, incites consciousness and brings to the fore ethical concerns and allows you to recognize the other amidst us, you know? So my belief is in inculcating that practice among our kids.
And Francine, I mean, even for you in the classroom, it's also about that art.
Yeah, well, I tend to pick books because I have a lot of freedom about what I can teach that I think are like great works of literature, but at the same time have some sort of historical reference. I mean, for example, Roberto Bolaño's By Night in Chile, which is set during the Pinochet regime in Chile. And it's always amazing to me, or not so amazing, I mean, I'm used to it by now, how few of my students know what happened in South America and Central America during the 70s and 80s, and what we as a country had to do with it. And which seems to me very important knowledge to have and very important knowledge not to let go. I think that people who teach literature, one of the things that it's about is what it means to be a human being, what it means. And I still believe that if you read a novel that's written from the consciousness of someone else's point of view, it at least gives you a window into thinking what it's like to be someone else, which is what I think is one of the things that's lacking in our political and cultural society at the moment. I mean, I was just thinking about how, you know, people talk about what's the divide, what's the cultural divide. Mm. And, you know, people say, well, it's religion versus secularism or you know, trad wife versus feminist, whatever. But I've been thinking that it's really about compassion, about whether you have to feel anything for somebody else or whether it's not your problem. And I think that's what's happening now. We don't, you know, we're encouraged to think you don't have to feel anything for some migrant from Venezuela who's about to get deported or the child of that person, whereas, you know, just worry about your own problems. So I think when I'm teaching that's coming through all the time. I mean, I'm sure my students think I'm like the biggest Debbie Downer that they've ever had because I do tend to pick books that at least alert them to what's happened in the past and what's not impossible to happen in the future.
You spent many years in the classroom, Lucy. Are you glad you're no longer there?
Actually, well, I'm relieved not to have to teach anymore because I was never very good at it. But I do miss the, the constant presence of young people in my life. I mean, it was invaluable source of information of a certain kind of knowing what was out there, what was being said. You know, the kind of what I hear from my students is very different from anything I could have gotten from the media. So that's something I'm not, I feel far less plugged in than what I did then.
Columbia, Harvard, Penn, all we know the stories. John, how do you see what's happening now and its impact on what we refer to as quote unquote academic freedom?
Well, first, I think the comment made earlier by the professor about the pandemic and historical knowledge, it's very striking how little we tend to remember of what happened, or maybe we've just put it out of our minds 20, 21, when we were really in the throes of the pandemic. The corollary to that is what happened after the Spanish influenza in 1918-19, and how, if you read the books about the that period, how immediately the whole country turned the page, and no one wanted to talk about it. And it's I think there's a parallel to what happened with COVID. Look, Columbia, Harvard, I mean, they really, when those college presidents sat in front of the committee and Elise Stefanik pressed them 3 different times and finally the 3rd time, they wouldn't admit or they wouldn't say that calling for violence against Jewish students somehow violated their academic principles and their code of behavior on campus. And what Columbia has done, basically aiding and abetting violent acts of anti-Semitism against Jewish students, is intolerable. And so I think, frankly, the administration has really used the powers that they have under law to crack down on that. And frankly, they take a lot of federal dollars. Now they have to, they have to accommodate that, and they can't engage and allow students to engage in anti-Semitic acts, and taking away an anonymity that these so-called brave protesters make, and they want to intimidate Jewish students. Now they're dealing with the consequences of it. So I am not at all sympathetic to what was going on at Harvard and Columbia and other places. And I think it's an important message. It really is. And, you know, so much I hear what folks on the left are saying and the concerns. And I have share some of the concerns about following the rule of law, et cetera. I think ultimately the courts are a check. I noticed that they sent more Venezuelans to Venezuela. They must have had some new accommodation with the thuggish regime down there. But they didn't use the Alien Act from 1798 as the justification. They used a different act. I think the administration is a very good chance of losing the case on the use of the Alien Enemies Act, the way that was brought about, because you need a declaration of war, or you need some kind of declaration that there's a invasion inspired by a hostile foreign power. Congress actually could address this by passing a resolution saying that what the Maduro regime has done, in which they, you know, Biden agreed to take plane loads of folks out of Venezuela, and it's well known that Maduro emptied his prisons, and among the people that they sent, not all certainly, were gang members and others who were hostile to the United States. And frankly, a lot of those guys are engaged in human trafficking, because what at the bottom line, why were they doing this? It was the money, because human trafficking pays off. And they send these gangs into the United States and through Latin America, through Mexico. And that's what was going on in a lot of respects. You know, one of the things about Trump And there's a lot to criticize about him, and I have done that. But one of the things that was in recent polling, the American public has asked, is he doing what he said he would do? And the answer is about 60% of Americans say, yes, he's doing what he said he would do. And the item where he has the strongest support is on immigration. And I think the big problem with the Biden administration is they basically opened the doors, and they made it extremely easy, and that was an issue. And if the Democrats want to fight on that issue, you know what? They're going to lose, because the public is overwhelmingly in favor of more border enforcement and stricter enforcement of federal laws. So I think, you know, it's very interesting when you saw all the tumult about Chuck Schumer supporting moving forward with the continuing resolution. The left had the exact same reaction that the right had when Ted Cruz and others said, oh, we can, by shutting down the federal government, we can get Obama to sign a bill to repeal Obamacare. It was never going to happen. And once the House passed the continuing resolution, Schumer was boxed, because he would have then owned shutting down the government. And for years, the left has said, you can't shut down the government. And I happen to agree with that. You should never shut down the government. But what's happening on the left right now with all this consternation and attacks on Schumer is a mirror image of what the right was doing, the base and the right attacking Mitch McConnell. You were too accommodationist to them. You didn't stand up and fight for us. It's the exact same thing going on.
Francine Prose, and we've got about 2 or 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Oh, I just want to go to back to the beginning of that about academic freedom. As a Jewish person, I feel that I should have the right to say what's anti-Semitic and not be told by a bunch of stone-cold anti-Semites giving the Nazi salute what's anti-Semitism or not. And I also feel that these people in government could really care less about anti-Semitism, that it's just an excuse to control the universities, which is in turn an excuse to stifle freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and God forbid, social mobility that allows people to move up the ladder. And that's the real purpose of that, and it's not to protect the rights of Jewish students on campus. It's not about that.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. I'm going to go out into the audience. We'll hear from our listeners and our audience members. I think they have things to say. We'll get to them in just a moment after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome back to our live broadcast from the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York. Good morning, all. We have a full house on this Wednesday morning, and we are thrilled. And again, thanks to the library for letting us use their space. I just want to give a quick shout out. The Rhinebeck Theater Society is presenting Amelia by Morgan Lloyd Malcolm, directed by Alan Honig. Anyone here going to be in that production? Okay, great. They're practicing. It's at the. It's right here at the library. Performances start March 28th. They run through April 6th. And you can find out more by going to rhinebecktheatersociety.org. They move their stuff to allow us to move in our stuff, and we thank them very much. It's a beautiful production, and I hope you get a chance to see it. I want to go out in the audience. I first just want to follow up on a couple of things that we talked about right before the break. Lucy, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about immigration.
Yeah, so besides being a trans weirdo, I'm also an immigrant, also a socialist for that matter, so I'm triply blessed. What John was saying before about, you know, Venezuela cleaning out their jails, et cetera. Well, there's some truth to that, It's also an accusation that's been hurled at waves of immigration since about the beginning of the 19th century. And you see editorial cartoons against, you know, well, yeah, there's all these Italian immigrants coming, and half of them are from the Cosa Nostra, and they're going to cut everybody's throats, or there are anarchists holding bombs in the editorial cartoons. It's always this way. And the fact is that it should, you know, there's politics, and there's Maduro's own evil schemes, because there's not just one evil dictator in the world. There are about 25 of them. And, you know, this, we forget about the people who are really need to immigrate for one reason or another, who have put themselves through unimaginable dangers and hardships to get here. And furthermore, the fact that the country needs them both in the sense that they need certain kinds of workers for jobs that Americans are not willing to do, but also for the fact that that is this nation's strength, besides its natural resources, is that we are a nation of immigrants. Unless you are a member of the First Nations, you are an immigrant. You're the child of immigrants. And everybody has, talk about lack of historical memory, you know, makes a clean division. Ah, yes, but our immigrants were legal, even though they came over the 19th century when there were no passports. You see, so this kind of thing becomes a truism, but immigration is filled with these criminals, therefore, and even kind of right-thinking moral persons suddenly want to be mean to immigrants, but really they're using it as an outlet for their own aggressions.
Amitava?
I also want to say that there's a bad faith involved in us welcoming goods and products which come at cheap prices from other countries, but not letting labor come from those countries, or making a show of exploiting that labor, or actually exploiting that labor and then not letting those bodies cross. Actually, with the change, you know, with the changes in the climate and with global warming, we should actually be prepared. Borders of all kinds, in all kinds of places, will fall. People will migrate. And if we recognize that and build for that future, we'll be in a much better place than we will be if we only seize our fears and react to it badly.
Donna.
I would echo everything that was just said. Along with also, you know, if you actually look at our immigration numbers and you go back into the 1980s when there was another, sort of surge of immigration, and you add and you account for the difference in population, the idea that our immigration numbers are up is actually not true. The amount of funding that we give towards refugee resettlement has actually decreased exponentially since that time period, right? So we've manufactured this crisis along the border, one, by not funding our border, by not funding our refugee asylum policies, by not providing support to the states that are receiving these refugees. And then we construct this crisis, and then we begin to say, oh, it's their fault. It's this sudden surge or the sudden wave. Our numbers, that's actually not the honest narrative, right? The honest narrative is, yes, there's been an increase, but that increase is no more than it has happened at other periods historically in the United States. The difference is we were able to meet those challenges. The difference is we were able to understand there's an increase, and we were actually able to effectively respond with legislation versus what we do now.
I want to go to the audience, but I've done this show long enough to know when Mark Whitman has a furrow in his brow. So I feel like I should ask him about the reason for the furrow.
Oh, it's not a direct response to what's been said. It's a reaction. I recently saw with a fellow irregular panelist who some of you may know. I went to see Macbeth, and the question on the drive home with my son was, who's the real villain? And I got ready. I was like, okay, well, I can answer this for him, right? Because I think it's clearly Lady Macbeth. And he said, no, it's the witches. Are you kidding me? He's like, look, they disrupt the natural order. They do it by using half-truths, appealing to avarice and to fear, and then they go away and bear no consequences for what they've done. And if you think of the temptations of what I'll call mutated populism in this nation and around the world, it starts the same way, or in many cases, very similar ways. and whether it be the issue of immigration with the half-truths and the fears, or any other you can take on. And to me, the central question still remains, how would that center of our electorate and our population, do we just give them enough defenses against those witches on the heath not to give in to their fears and their temptations?
Peter has been waiting patiently in the audience. Hello, Peter.
I'm in that badass camp with Francine Prose, and my question's about resistance. And I have trouble with word retrieval, so I'm just going to read what I wrote this morning. Less than 2 weeks ago, 50,000 people filled the streets in Budapest to denounce Orban's autocratic abuses and his coziness with Vladimir Putin. In proportion to the total population, that protest would translate to more than 1,750,000 people in the United States. Last Friday, 34,000 people turned out in Denver to hear Bernie and AOC rail against the emerging oligarchy. Thank you, in America.
Here to help.
Inspiring for sure, but not Budapest. Among the other forms of resistance, the courts, the Congress, and the press, what part might truly massive demonstrations play in reversing our slide into Trump's autocratic dystopia? And there's a question of timing, of course, by one of the panel members.
Who would like that one? Don't all jump at once.
I can take that one.
Okay, please.
Anna Markowitz. I think that during the first Trump presidency, there were a lot of protests. People were saying, oh, well, maybe people don't know our view. And so we went out and we told them our view. And I think people are really disheartened that the fact that that didn't matter. People know that he was a convicted felon. They know all of his atrocities, and they continue to vote for him. And I think people are very worn down and tired and have been reticent to get out there and protest again. I'm hoping that we're turning the corner and we're drinking some coffee and we're getting ready for round two, because I think that given the level of destruction that we've been seeing, it's time to speak out and to really rally. So I'm hoping that we can follow in our nice European footsteps and get the word out there. And I'm not sure what will get us to have like a 1.7 million person, you know, if he goes after something really large, like I said, with Social Security or healthcare. I think that something will push us to that level. And I do hope that we fight back.
Elizabeth?
I'm just sitting here remembering the Women's March right after the first Trump inauguration and our pink pussy hats and our joy at being together and our rage and our fear and our love for each other and what we stood for. And I don't really know when that moment is going to be again, or if that moment will arise or should arise or is going to be the most effective way to do it. I'm interested in what's effective. We are so tribalized right now in this country. Everything that we do to counter, and I'm not talking about the elected officials, I'm talking about our brothers and sisters in the country who vote differently than we do. And I prefer to see them as valid human beings, most of them good human beings who have a different opinion than I do. And I think it's very important to hold that possibility. Otherwise, what really ends in genocide is when countries turn against each other in civil war, which happened once in this country. And I don't think that's where we want to go. On the other hand, it may come to the point when the only action is to go into the streets. I don't think we're there right now. Personally, I'm focusing on the midterm elections, still believing enough in our country that if we elect enough so that we turn the tide in the Congress and the Senate, that it'll make a difference. I still believe that. Maybe if that goes from my point of view, then I'll meet you in the streets.
Cynthia is with us. She's from Rhinebeck, so she didn't have very far to go. let me stop me if you've heard this story, but this is a rarity, and I'm thrilled that she's here because it's like finding a unicorn. But she lived in New York City for 61 years and then moved to Rhinebeck. Can you imagine? You want to talk about immigration as well?
Yeah. First, I say I thought I moved to another planet, but actually I moved from another planet. Ray, immigration, where is our humanity? Who among us wakes up on a morning and says, this is a swell day to strap a baby to my back and walk bleeping 2,000 miles for a better life for my family? What a swell idea. My feeling is it's happening to one of us, it's happening to all of us. And community is the only thing that's going to save us.
Anyone want to respond? Yes, Lucy.
Talking about bringing people out into the streets, there are demonstrations in every American city every weekend. They're everywhere. I live in Kingston. There was a big protest, which I only heard about because I was driving by, at the post office protesting against the what we've been terrified of for years, that last bit of the commons that we still have, the post office, the privatization of it. Anyway, the fact is, these demonstrations, some of them huge, in New York City, filling up streets, barely get covered in the press anymore. The Washington Post has gone to the dark side. The New York Times is genuflecting every day to this power. I'm not sure street demonstrations have anything to do right now. I think if we're going to do anything, it's got to be economic. There have been a couple of days of like not buying anything. It's very hard to get any kind of statistics on what might have resulted from this, but there's no question it's going to come to the need for a general strike, and that means shutting down all business for a day, for a week, some way that actually impacts those people who are in charge. Because it's not even so much really in these things about inspiring your neighbors. Yes, demonstrations do that. They're mostly for the benefit of the demonstrators. But if you want to make an impact on the powers, then taking away some of their money is about the only way to go.
Mark?
I understand the symbolism of a day of not buying anything, but if you don't buy gas on Friday, you're going to either stock up on Thursday or buy it Monday. So unless it's targeted and sustained, I think those types of boycotts are very difficult as a effective political instrument, frankly.
So what is effective, John?
Well, I think everyone has a right to voice their opinion, and people are doing that. And every 2 years, we have an election for 435 members of the House. Only about 30 of those seats are actually competitive. We have every 2 years, about 33 U.S. senators run, and every 4 years, a president runs. You know, I just think that so many of the responses are actually not really going to work for the left. I mean, we had modestly 12 to 15 million people come into the United States when Biden basically opened the borders. And I'm very sympathetic to refugees and immigrants and realizing why they come here. But I think we all have to be cognizant, again, of history. We've gone through these ebbs and flows in our history. And we had the Asian Exclusion Acts in the 1880s. And we had keep those Italians, like some of my forebears, out in the 1920s, just too many of them were coming. And we know about the signs in the window, don't hire the Catholics. I mean, so we go in ebbs and flows. But the natural reaction of most people is they look and they see 15 million people coming through the country, many of them illegal, And they say that shouldn't how it should be. I mean, we have a system of laws, we have borders, and the same reaction you're seeing, this is what the reaction was in Germany to Angela Merkel's policy. Besides her crazy shut down all the nuclear power plants, which made her Germany more dependent on Russia for energy, that was a major impact in the German election, which swung to the right in Germany. So what's happening, the reaction against the tide of illegal immigration is a natural reaction that people here had. And I think if Democrats are going to kind of fight on that hill, they're going to lose politically. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. And this is an issue where Trump is near 60% approval in the actions he's taken. So I've talked to a bunch of Republicans, and they say, geez, you know, the Democrats are fighting about these issues that, you know, like I heard someone the other day say, oh, because I don't agree with the way in which USAID was handled, for instance. And I know there are a fair number of people on the Republican side who share my view. However, you are not going to win the argument with the American people when you say you're cutting, quote unquote, foreign aid. Because the American public, if you ask them in a polling, they think 30% or 40% of the whole budget is foreign aid. They're completely off base. It's less than 1%. So there are a lot of good programs that we have done through USAID, and then there are some really wacky ones that shouldn't get funded. And so you're going to see this now go into the control of the State Department. USAID operated almost like an entity unto itself. And so there'll be more, the president and the executive has supremacy when it comes to foreign policy. And so I think you're going to see that. But I'll tell you, folks, for the left to be fighting on the hills they're going on, they're going to lose.
Oh, can I?
Could I say something?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, any one of us who happens to know a doctor well enough to speak informally knows that one of the things that's already happened with the cuts to USAID, is that mostly in Africa, but in other countries around the world, people can't get the basic medicines they need to live. They can't get malaria medicines, they can't get AIDS medicines. So already tens of thousands of people are in risk of dying. So it's not as if, you know, it's just a matter of money and we're spending too much and it's, you know, the checks and on. I mean, it's actually happening right now that there's a lot of death of people resulting from these cuts. And we're not hearing about it. It's not being presented that way. The media is not telling us the truth about it. And we need to know the consequences of what's being done.
There was the George W. Bush PEPFAR program, which saved millions of lives in Africa. And you remember back a few years ago, George W. Bush was being demonized as being the great Satan. But that was a program which has strong bipartisan support, and I think that'll continue. But you're absolutely correct. Some of the way in which they've gone about dealing with issues like AID have been counterproductive. And they're also cutting off like Radio Free Europe and the broadcasting into China and Russia so people can actually hear contrary opinions about what's going on in their countries is really valuable. And I think that's very short-sighted to eliminate that funding.
All right. We have a lot of questions here from the audience, and I want to get to those. Let's take a quick break so we can free up some time so we can go uninterrupted. We'll be right back after this. Believe it or not, we're already running low on time, so we'll try to get to as many questions, go into the lightning round here. Mark, you start.
Yes. Everybody wonders, like, when are we at that point? Okay, we are at the point where we are plucking people off the street, deporting them without due process. Okay, that's happening now. Is that enough, or is it enough when they drug them, throw them on a plane, and dump them out in the ocean? All right, because that's happened before. All right, so I want to know, when is it enough? And it should be a United States problem, not a left problem, not a right problem.
Anybody want to respond to that? Go ahead.
I'm not that quick, but what I want to ask in reference to that is, I think it was Ms. Prose who mentioned the compassion. I believe that we are in the state we are because of a lack of compassion, and because we, as people in this country, look at our own belly buttons and only care about our own belly buttons. And you all talked about the toggle. when do we toggle out of, you all have wonderful professions, you're doing wonderful things, but when do we toggle out of the ordinary? Because I admire Mr. Faso for being here, for being on the roundtable. I listen every day. I think about one little thing. I try to be kinder. But people are hurting. We are not the America, the United States that we thought we all were. And checks and balances is gone. I don't care what anyone says. We don't have to argue about the little things. But I remember as a teenager thinking about Nazi Germany and thinking, why didn't people stop this? What's different now than that? We are not stopping it. Protests aren't going to matter. I was at the Women's March. What are we going to do? We have to stop society. I'm not waiting 2 years for the midterm elections. People are dying, hurting, getting so scared. But us, who are the 1%, I mean, essentially, if we're here, we're the 1%, aren't hurting enough yet. What's it going to take for us to hurt enough to care about the people who are powerless? Because I'm so ashamed, and I know many of you are, and the world has lost hope in us. What can we do?
Amitava?
You know, there's a writer called Carlo Ginzburg who says, thank you for your comments, both of you. There's a writer called Carlo Ginzburg who says, my feeling about my country is not necessarily, I belong to a country not because I love the country, but because I feel shame about it. And I think that turn, where patriotism is defined as something where you begin to become ashamed of what your country is doing, is a necessary move. And I think both these questions are in some ways articulating that position. I certainly, about my country of origin, feel a bit of shame about the direction it is taking. And as to what will become the turning point, I think one should be open to the point, if you think about history or even contemporary history, the death of a Tunisian fruit seller on a street led to the Arab Spring. The point is to be alert to change, to stay alert, and to stay alert and alive to the possibility, actually, of a revolution. And it will sometimes take bodies on the street, but it's also a certain, what Gramsci called, optimism of the will, you know? Pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. So let's not get ourselves down too much.
Optimism of the will. I'm going to go right behind you here because we're waiting patiently. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, Margaret.
Margaret, what would you like to tell this group?
Well, I'd like to say that about the Columbia University students rioting. I feel like they aren't the Palestinians hurting the Jewish students so much as the Palestinians are rioting and saying they don't like Netanyahu's policy and our policies supporting it, not necessarily against the Jewish student body.
Anyone on that?
Well, yeah, I think that's, really, I have to disagree with Margaret. I think when you see the demonstrations and you see the intimidation and the takeover of buildings and the violence and this notion that, oh, we have a right to encamp and disrupt everyone else, you saw it at the beginning of this semester. Students went into a class that an Israeli professor was teaching on the Middle East, disrupting it, handing out pamphlets. Fortunately, those students, as I understand it, have now been expelled. I mean, the fact that they've allowed this to happen without any consequences just encourages more. When people say from the river to the sea, they're talking about extinguishing the Jewish state. Oh. And I just, for the life of me, again, this is an issue. And you look at the last election. Trump received almost half of the Jewish vote, which is astonishing in New York State. And it's all because of these anti-Semitic acts at places like Columbia and the failure of the universities to uphold freedom of expression. As long as you were attacking Jewish kids, it didn't seem to matter.
These are appalling statements, really. These are appalling statements because all the persecution is of students. If you talk about expulsions, you're certainly talking about consequences. Let's also talk about the illegal detention of a person like Mahmoud Khalil the other day. You know, if you talk about that the first 27 pages of the list of people who have been killed in Gaza is only of children, of babies whose, you know, year is marked as 00, to even mention such a thing is to attract from people on the right the label of being an anti-Semite. That's a grave falsification of the truth, you know? And so the real violence is either of the state violence there or of the violence of an administration here that is ready to condemn any protest, any voice that is raised as bigoted. I think that is really appalling.
Francine.
Yeah, no, I think it's very hard for students or for anyone to live in a moment knowing that tens of thousands of people are being innocent, children are being killed, and our government is helping to pay for it, and that's happening at this moment. So, I mean, and also, I think on the day that, I don't approve of invading classrooms, just as a rule, but I think on the day that the Barnard classroom was invaded, that around that same day, we killed 400 children in Gaza. So if I have to weigh those two things, the deaths of 400 children versus somebody making it unpleasant to be in a classroom, as much as I don't like the classroom invasion, I'm going to go with worrying about the death of the 400 children.
That's right. Jeff is... Jeff is from Poughkeepsie. Go, Jeff.
Well, as a prophet, I think 30 or 40 years from now, when we look back at what...
Is that on your card?
I wrote it myself.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
30, 40 years from now, when you look back on what's going on now, it's just another up and down in the life cycle of democracy that we take three or four steps forward and one step back. And eventually it will level off. And we've made a lot of progress in a whole bunch of areas, and Trump can declare what he wants, but we aren't going back on many issues. So my real question is, what's the turning point? I think the turning point is when the felon chokes on a cheeseburger. And I'm wondering what kind of food the panel would prefer that he chokes on.
What a lovely turn of phrase. That's very nice. Does anybody want to handle that, or can we move on safely to the next question? Thank you, Prophet. All right. Anyone over here? Yes. All right. Getting to the back of the room here. Go ahead, sir.
Should I hang? Okay. No. Oh, you hold it. Okay. So this is for Mark, okay? Because you earlier you said, and I feel the same way, that the Democratic Party has lost the center. Now, what about the prospect, okay, that the party potentially might be taken over by AOC, Hakeem Jeffries, and some others that are further left than like Chuck Schumer?
Mark Whitman.
You'll be the prophet now.
Yeah. Playing the role of the prophet. Yeah. In this break,
so his brow is furrowed.
Yeah, yes, look, absolutely.
It's a great question. What do the Democrats need to do? My answer, driven by pragmatism, not surprising for a banker, is that would be a disaster. I really do respect those folks. I respect their views. I respect their energy. But if you look at the presidents on the Democratic side who really won over the middle, who was it? Right? It was Barack Obama, right, and Bill Clinton. They were populist outsiders who spoke to America in a way that party machinists did not and could not. And so frankly, I think the current roster of who's available is probably the wrong answer, at least if they're at the top of that roster. And I have an immense amount of hope that on the left, someone with charisma to match sort of the nefarious charisma we've seen on the right will be the leader that we need, even if they are imperfect, perhaps not steeped in politics or Washington, I think we need to return. I think most likely if the Democrats are successful, it will be because they returned to that model, frankly.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we will finish up our time together at the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliffe, New York, before this beautiful live audience and an amazing roster. We thank you all for being with us and for listening. We'll return for our wrap-up right after this. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the round table in our live broadcast from Rhinecliffe, New York. You can almost see the river. It's really beautiful, and it's a gorgeous day, and we thank all of you for being here. Before we run out of time, there's a bunch of people I want to thank from our team that put this amazing event together. And from all the folks at WAMC, Peter Hughes, Amber Sickles, Kayla Sacco, Peyton Walker, Nate Scheid, Rob Chacon, of course, Sarah LaDuke, Madeline Reynolds, and our CEO, Sarah Gilbert. A big, big hand. These are wonderful people to work with and to go on the road with and to know that it's everything's going to be great because they're so good at what they do. Thanks to Empire Audio for... Are we buying it or do we lend it? Do they lend it? Okay. I have to know how much of a plug I give them. Okay, well, Empire Audio, thank you very much for your incredible donation. We appreciate it. Thanks to the Morton Memorial Library and to Sandy. Sandy, we love you. You are amazing. How are you?
I'm so happy. I am thrilled to have you all here.
You know, I've told this story a million times, but I'll tell it a million and one. My mom was a librarian. This is a very special place for me. I love libraries. My first job was at a library. You do God's work, and you do it so well. And your love and attention and your comfort, not only to us, but to this community, is unmatched. And I thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you very, very much. All right. Now let's go back to the depressing stuff. Okay.
Joe, could I say something?
You sure can, sir.
It just struck me that the question has been raised, what will be a turning moment? And I just realized during the break that when Musk goes after Morton Library, or when he goes after you, Joe, there will be a change, a definite shift.
Well, there may be a hearing on that going on right now. I'm not sure I... I haven't gotten an update. Brian, what's on your mind?
Thank you, Joe, and thank you, the panel. I mean, this is a highly educated panel.
All right.
professors, educators. Trump has indicated that he loves stupid people.
The uneducated.
Excuse me. And the average person in the United States reads less than 4 books, which that's a medium, which means it's closer to 0. My question to you.
That was my commute.
What do we do in America about the disenfranchised individuals that I think were drawn to Trump that, quite frankly, don't respect or understand education?
Who would like that one?
Well, the first thing we do is dismantle the Department of Education, apparently. So, we've systematically destroyed the U.S. public educational system for the last 30 or 40 years. And if I had to think of one thing that's responsible for where we are, it would be that. I mean, you just defund the schools, make, you know, 45 kids in class, and you get a population that can't think or reason or process information, which is what we have. So,
what? Last
well, Joe, I
yeah, go ahead.
I was a staffer on the Hill going to law school at night in 1979 when our committee passed the Department of Education.
And the Department of Education was purely a political payback from Jimmy Carter to the teachers union. It had nothing else to do but that. And the Department of Education, if you look at the 40 years or so that we've had the U.S. Department of Education, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the scores go down. And one of the reasons I was the original sponsor of charter schools in New York State, which we have a strong charter law, which the Democrats actually are prohibiting to expand at the behest of the teachers union. The kids who most benefit from charters are African-American and Hispanic and minority kids, and they're standing in the schoolhouse door, proverbially, to stop the expansion of charters. Charters are so critical because we need competition in education, like we have in every other vein of our lives. Competition produces better results, and yet we are stymieing competition and we're blocking kids. You look at the absenteeism rates. I just looked at these the other day. Among the worst school districts in the whole country are Syracuse and Rochester. And the chronic absenteeism is, you know, over 40% in these places. And we wonder why kids don't learn. You know, if we're going to prosper in the future, we need to do much better. And the U.S. Education Department has nothing to do with education, which is primarily a K-12 state-level, local-level function, and yet we are still failing at that. And it's not because of lack of money. We're spending over $30,000 per child in New York State's K-12 system, and look at the results. So if you're wealthy and you can move to Scarsdale, or you can, you know, live here in Rhinebeck and you get a nice school district, or in Kinderhook where I live, oh, you're fine because you can afford it. But if you're stuck sending your kids to a failing school which repeatedly fails over and over, and the teacher unions and the education establishment that runs the union, the schools in this state, they're more concerned about the adults in the system and not the kids. And that's just a fact. And I agree, K-12 education is a disaster. And also, there was a recent survey of universities, and the kids in even in high-level Ivy League prime schools don't read books. So this is a big problem. I agree. It's a big problem. But the way we're going about it, we're defending an institution like a bureaucracy, but we're not getting, you know, focused on teaching kids phonics and how to read and understand math and science. That's our future. And yet we continue to ignore it because we pay more attention to the adults that feed in the system than the welfare of the kids.
Anna Markowitz.
Yeah, well, I, for one, think that the Department of Education is a highly important institution, which the only reason why we know that our kids are falling behind is because we are tracking their successes and failures, and that's done by the Department of Education. So I'd like to continue to monitor that so that we can teach our students more. School meals. Are we going to cut school meals, and that's going to help our children learn more? So I think that we should be funding education more, not cutting it. And when we're talking about charter schools, I worked in for Teach for America for a long time, and I'm pretty familiar with charter schools. And we actually, I think, funded them wrong. When public schools lose a student, they lose the money, and that money goes to a charter school. And so facilities like a gym or a music teacher, which aren't impacted by how many students, that it costs the same amount for that music teacher, no matter if you have 100 students or 10 students, all of a sudden you can't have a music class because you lost your funding to a charter school. And so I think that we should be thinking about how we're funding our school so that we can best serve our students and not be pitting things against each other and offering less funding. I don't think less funding is the option.
Elizabeth Lesser.
No. Well, I kind of want to go back to what happened at Barnard last week, 2 weeks ago, whenever it was. I went to Barnard in the 1970s. I was at Columbia in Hamilton Hall, shutting down the hall in the anti-Vietnam War days. And
a co-badass.
Okay, go ahead. And
We were very effective in doing that. We helped stop the war in Vietnam. The students did. And I really do think that what has been going on at Columbia and other universities is a legitimate and sincere attempt to change the policy of America supporting the Netanyahu regime in Israel. On the other hand, one piece of historical memory that we have not lost is the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. And I think both of them are real, and both concerns have been real. And the inability for people on both sides to talk to each other and figure out a way to figure out what's going on in the university without deporting someone illegally, that's what's upsetting me the most right now, is the flagrant misuse of the law to deport someone who deserves his day in court.
Most of our guests on this panel are best-selling authors, and I just want to mention their latest works because they are incredible. Elizabeth Lesser is the author of Cassandra Speaks, When Women Are the Storytellers, The Human Story Changes, which is out from Harper and is just a powerful and beautiful and thoughtful book, and that is Cassandra Speaks. Amitabha Kumar's latest novel, now in paperback, is My Beloved Life. This was I love all your books, but this was really my favorite. What was the one before this?
A Time Outside This Time.
Okay, that was my favorite. But this is second best. Second best. That's really good. Amazing, amazing stuff. You mentioned the 1970s. Francine Prose's latest is a memoir, A Personal History, 1974. Well, you got around to 1974. That's a hell of a book. Amazing story. We have a great interview, because of her, on the book show. Well, actually, I think with everybody here on our archive, and you can check that out. So, 1974 by Francine Prose, out in hardcover. Lucy Sant's new book is just out in paperback, and it is absolutely incredible and a bestseller. I Heard Her Call My Name, a memoir of transition, and an absolutely stunning volume from Lucy Sant. And last but certainly not least, a new novel from Denham Mengistu, author of All Our Names, and the book is Someone Like Us. And that is also just a stunning, stunning novel. And I thank all of you for your beautiful work, and I look forward to plugging Mark, John, and Anna's books in the future. All right, we have a few minutes, and I just want to throw this out because we've gone into a lot of corners, and this is sort of played out exactly as I was hoping it would, because you're all so wonderful, and I thank you for that. But let me just ask maybe we've already countered this. I don't know, but I'm interested if anyone we'll go until we run out of time, but I'm interested if anyone would like to lead the pack here in where your optimism lies and where you and where maybe even we can find overall hope.
My faith lies in education, really. And in education, I don't simply mean what happens in the classroom, but what happens in forums like this. What happens in public posts that someone like Francine writes in The Guardian, for example, and then that is shared in social media. Because the real danger is, if people remain uneducated, it's not that they will vote Republican, though that's a grave danger in my mind, but the real danger is that the army of the uneducated and the unemployed, the army of the unemployable, will become the stormtroopers of the most regressive regime that our country can perhaps imagine. And so our commitment has to be...
That is hopeful.
So the hope is that if we educate ourselves and we do speak the truth and if we practice good faith, then there is a way out of this.
I certainly very strongly agree with that. And, you know, I think as soon as we begin to stop imagining that most of what's happening is happening to someone else, I think we're going to understand just how critical it is that we act in our own self-preservation. Like, he's not going after students with green cards because he just wants to go after those individuals, right? He's like, I'm coming for you, right? What I'm doing is I'm creating a culture and a climate of fear that lets you know that my power will exceed beyond anything you might have imagined before. And we've watched this attack sort of move from, like, the margins, yes, USAID, and it's getting closer and closer. And it is finally, I think, starting to feel like it's here at home. I think once we begin to really understand and allow ourselves to experience and feel that, and once we feel like we are liable to each other, and not just because those people are from over there, but because what he is doing to them is a forecast of what he will do to us, and that if we don't protect them, we are not protecting ourselves, that act of self-preservation will hopefully, I think, sort of move us forward. But it's also an act of communion, right? It's the moment we begin to understand that we do not exist in isolation, and we live in a plurality, and in order for that plurality to be possible, we have to stand up for one another.
My hope is that when we talk about standing up for each other, we also talk about having panels like this with John, and that there would be more than just one John on a panel, because I think humanizing the other, whether that's a person of another race or another religion or another country or another political party, I think it is so critical that I've never met John before, but in my mind he was John Faso, you know that. And now he's a person, and I really
Oh, Elizabeth.
And
I don't know that the tests have come back yet, Elizabeth, but we'll check.
But I really think it's critical we reach out, not just to the others we think it's easy to reach out to, but ask yourself who's the person you would most not like to talk to, and find those people and humanize each other.
You know, we work really hard to get that. Thank you. We work really hard to get as many opinions on this program as possible, and we work on it. We continue to work on it. We will continue to work on it. John has always been there for us. I've been at the radio station for 30 years. He has been there since I've been there, and he's always there. He's so supportive and so wonderful, and I thank you so much for being here and for sharing your ideas and being so open to a forum like this.
1-800-323-9262.
You're damn right. 1-800-323-9262. Let me thank everyone this morning. It's been an amazing morning. I will not forget this one for a long, long time. What an amazing group. And I'm just stunned by everyone. Thank you to the wonderful audience. Thank you for participating. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for coming. And thank you for supporting WAMC. Thank you for making that phone call, for calling 1-800-323-9262 and being with us. We appreciate it. So big hand to the audience. Thank you very much. Also, John Faso, Anna Markowitz, and Mark Whitman, all of you are wonderful. You are our regular panelists. We rely on you day in, day out, and we thank you so much for all you do, not just today, but in every day in all of the panels that you participate in. So thank you so much for being with us. And finally, just this amazing group that we put together. I now know this show has now gone on 2 hours, so I no longer remember whether I told this story on the air yet or if I told it backstage. But I made a list, a dream list, and I put it out, and everyone responded right away and said that they would do the show, and I was absolutely stunned. My thanks to Amitava Kumar, Elizabeth Lesser, Dinah Mengestu, Francine Prose, Lucy Sant. Thank you all very much. Another hour of the roundtable is coming up. We'll be back in the studio tomorrow, and more trips to come. We love you. Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.